ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to my second last ever edition of The Stage Show. Yes, I'm calling it a day. 25 years ago, I joined ABC Radio National as the presenter of a weekday program called Arts Today, and that was an alarmingly public way of learning a new job. And today, you and I are looking back at some of the fun, some of the highlights of those 25 years. Good morning and welcome. This is Arts Today, coming to you from Launceston in Tasmania. I'm Michael Cathcart.
Here at the ABC's Ultimo Centre in Sydney, I'm your quizmaster, Michael Cathcart.
Welcome to Bush Telegraph. Today, it's all aboard Valerie's bus. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, coming to you from Times Square in the heart of New York. We're off to Morocco today.
And welcome to the audience here at the Melbourne Writers' Festival.
Live at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
You and I are in the famous Smiggle tent of the Adelaide Cabaret Festival.
Look, I had huge fun when the listeners and I had a close encounter with the massive organ at the Melbourne Town Hall. Back in 2001, that organ had just been refurbished at the cost of $4 million, and I got to sit with the organist Calvin Bowman at the organ console, which is halfway up the back wall, the stage wall of the Town Hall, with all these big pipes towering above you. Here's Calvin putting the pedals of the new organ to the test. All this is done with his feet, and you'll hear me having my turn. Now, look, there's just you and me here. All my life I've wanted to have a go at this.
Sure, you're welcome to. So would you like a big go or a small go?
A big go.
Okay, this is a big noise for you.
This is me making a really big noise on the Town Hall organ. I can't believe I'm about to do this. How was that? That's about the most thrilling thing I've ever done on Arts Today. Okay, Calvin, show us how it's really done. The famous Trumpet Voluntary by the English composer Jeremiah Clarke. For the relaunch of the organ, the City of Melbourne commissioned the New York composer Philip Glass to write a piece of music. Now, the organ consists of hundreds of pipes, so, of course, the logical thing to do is to pair the organ with the didgeridoo, which consists of just one pipe. Philip Glass collaborated on this with the great Yamiche musician Mark Atkins, and I asked Philip Glass how long it took Philip, to agree to this idea.
Immediately, because one of the great icons of Middle European classical music, the organ, we think of the organ as being really a part of that history, but the didgeridoo is an icon of indigenous music here. So you have these two pillars of each of their own musical tradition, and they have this commonality, which is that they're wind instruments. Mm. As soon as I got the invitation, I said, yes, I do it.
And how did you know what the capabilities of the organ were?
I could tell that it was going to make a really big noise. What I didn't know was the size of the room, which I only discovered yesterday. It's a very big room. Mm. It's a very good setup for an organ of that size.
Mm. Now, Mark, you've played with an incredible range of people. Robert Plant and Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin fan, Irish musician Donald Lunny, the London Philharmonic, all sorts of people. You've even played on the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Has this project with Philip taken you into new territory, musically speaking?
You bet. The didgeridoo had a name for being a drone instrument, if you like. And I try to sort of I've seen it as more of an instrument that could play, be a lead instrument, if you like, a solo instrument, rather than just a drone instrument. This piece, work with Phil, was a perfect opportunity to develop my particular style.
The other day, I snuck in the back door at the town hall and listened to a rehearsal, and it struck me, Philip Glass, that there was a way in which the organ was the kind of moving ground of the piece, and the didgeridoo was the kind of, not quite the melodic line, but it was...
Well, I did really want to feature the didgeridoo. I knew Mark's playing from... I'd heard quite a lot of this music, maybe just on CDs I'd gotten here and there, and he's a real virtuoso. Mm. He's a master of this instrument. So what I did is I began writing a piece of music, and I left places for it, not knowing exactly what Mark would do, though I didn't know what keys he... I remember before he came, I sent him a note saying, you should bring a didgeridoo that's in B-flat, bring one in F, bring one in C. Actually, he brought all of those, plus one that was variable pitch so that we could make up other things. And he, when he came to New York, I had already written a lot of music. I left places for the didgeridoo to be fit into it. So we were able to actually fit the organ and the didgeridoo together. It's really, I mean, it's like having some, putting a suit of clothes on someone in a certain way. Mm. It was and we were able to do it. The time we spent, we were able to very rapidly to close the distance between the two instruments.
Here's a little of how it sounds. That's from Voices for Organ, Didgeridoo and Narrator by Philip Glass with organist Calvin Bowman, the wonderful didge player Mark Atkins, performing together at the Melbourne Town Hall in May 2001. In 2012, we took the Books and Arts Show to the Big Apple, and I want to go back there for a moment. My guide was Tony Sheldon, the Australian actor and musical theatre star. Tony was the son of the much-loved actor, singer, vaudevillian, woman of many talents, Tony Lamont, who died just last week, actually. When we spoke, Tony Sheldon reflected on his lineage, and he took me to meet Broadway royalty. Well, we're just off Broadway. You've just brought us to probably the only quiet spot within Cooey of here. Where are we exactly?
We're on 49th Street next door to the Ambassadors, the E&E Cafe, which is the local hangout for the cast of Chicago. They come here every night after their show.
So, you've got theatre in your genes.
I do. In fact, all my trousers. I'm third generation. My grandparents, both sets of grandparents, were in vaudeville at the Tivoli and Variety. My father was a dancer and then a TV producer. And my mother is Tony Lamond, the cabaret and musical theatre star. My aunt is Helen Reddy. So the pop singer. I deliberately set out to be a classical actor because I thought that was the only way I wouldn't be compared skill-wise to the other family members.
So, Tony, where are we going now?
I'm going to take you down to the Richard Rogers Theatre to meet Audra McDonald, who is currently playing Bess in Porgy and Bess. She's a 5-time Tony Award winner. And her fiancé, Will Swenson, was my co-star in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And Will is a Tony nominee for Hair. And the two of them are going to be waiting backstage in the dressing room to meet you.
Isn't this exciting?
It's the most excited I have been all month.
Now, congratulations, Audra. The audience went wild the night that we were here. They just went mental.
Yeah, the audiences have been really responsive and appreciative. And I think because the show, you know, because we've condensed it, the big moments come really quickly. And so they don't really have a chance to react during the show. So it's all sort of pent up. And then at the end, they usually erupt because they've been sort of sitting on their hands the entire time.
You must be on a high every night.
Well, I wouldn't call it a high because the role is so physical and draining and emotional that usually by the end, I'm just sort of in the clouds somewhere, but not necessarily a high.
Acting
well,
high.
Yes, an acting high.
This is Will Swenson. Hi, Will.
Oh, I'm interrupting. Hello.
You should explain your relationship to this lovely woman.
Oh, I'm going to marry her.
Isn't that fantastic? And it's really soon.
Yes, it's sooner rather than later. Yes, we're very excited.
So for the radio audience who doesn't know the show, just tell us quickly who Bess is.
Well, this is a show that takes place in the 1930s. It was written in the 1930s, and they usually call it present day, in a part of Charleston called Catfish Row. Well, it was called Cabbage Row. That's the actual place in Charleston, but George Gershwin renamed it to Catfish Row. And they're African Americans living and working. They're fishermen and domestic workers. And Bess is a character who's a bit of a fallen woman. She is not married. She's sort of the girlfriend of an abusive stevedore boyfriend named Crown. And Crown comes in to hang out with the boys of Catfish Row, has a crap game, gets in a fight and kills someone and has to go on the run. And so Bess is left all alone and needs someone to take care of her. So she gets taken in by a poor beggar who lives in Catfish Row named Porgy. And they fall in love. And then Crown comes back and demands to have Bess back. And many dramatic things happen. Yeah.
She reminds me a bit of Carmen.
Yes, I guess you could say that. You know, they certainly both are loose women, to say the least, and have very self-destructive, I think, sort of personalities. Bess also is very, very addicted to happy dust, which is like a form of cocaine. In that sense, she's got inner demons as well as sort of her outward sort of circumstances that keep her somewhat shackled.
It's actually a show with a great sense of the community, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. Okay, see, you've got one or two characters who are powerfully drawn, and then there's this incredibly rich community, which is a very supportive group of people who are also just trying to sort of get by.
Absolutely. Well, that, you know, certainly was the historical sort of accuracy of Cabbage Row. There was very many African Americans living in a very small sort of what looked like a slum at those times. Now they're lovely apartments, but what it was is basically a broken down mansion, you know, 60 to 70 people living in this one teeny tiny little area, and they really all depended upon each other and supported each other. And so Bess is very much an outsider. She sort of brings in the storm to their community in a way, but then becomes accepted by the community, but then also causes a lot of the drama as a result.
Audra, you trained at the Juilliard School as a classical singer. Is this the kind of voice that you would use if you were singing opera? Is it the same voice?
I mean, I use the same technique for all of my singing. I guess you just go by whatever the music dictates. But, I mean, there are belty moments in this, you know? And I tell you what, you listen to certain Verdi recordings of Leontine Price singing Verdi Requiem, and I defy you to say that she is not belting some of the lower notes in the Dies Irae or something like that. She is belting her tits off, even though it's an operatic thing. So it just, I think, depends on what the music calls for and what the composer sort of dictates that makes the decision. But in all of it, you just try and go for healthy singing.
Is there a role you'd really love to play?
I'm doing it right now. This is it.
Train is at the station, and you Audra McDonald there speaking about the musical Porgy and Bess, for which she later won a Tony Award. We had such fun in her dressing room, I can't tell you. Now, the interview, which was the most challenging to prepare, took place a couple of years after that at the Melbourne Writers Festival with the, I guess, esoteric, is that the word, English novelist Will Self. And I really wrestled with his 2012 novel Umbrella, which is four hundreds of pages swirling with streams of consciousness. There are no talking marks, hardly any paragraphs. There's nothing really to help you figure out who's talking. And on the first reading, this novel made no sense at all to me. But I persisted with this. I went back to the beginning and I read the whole thing again a second time. And I guess I was about a third of the way through when I just broke through. It was an uncanny sensation. I suddenly knew who was speaking. I knew where we were. I knew who was in the room. And the sequel to that, a book called Shark, was even more extreme in the way Will Self used this style. He was evoking the psychological storms that had descended on various people who carried out the bombing of Hiroshima. They were involved in flying the plane and making the bomb, all that kind of stuff. And this book, Shark, is just one long paragraph. There are no talking marks once again. And the strangeness of it took you into a world of human pain and longing. There was something about getting away from an orderly book with paragraphs and so on into a kind of surreal hyper-reality that was free of the conventions of ordinary writing. I said all this to Will Self and then asked him whether he just made his dialogue up.
I sit in cafes and restaurants and on public transports with an open notebook noting down people's dialogue. And that's how any writer gets. Dialogue is notoriously difficult. You know, the technical term is everybody has an idiolect. Everybody speaks in a very particular way. And again, if I'm complaining about characters not shitting enough in literary fiction, I also would complain about dialogue as well, because, you know, there's very little attempt made by a lot of writers to really try and capture how people speak and how we can infer from how they speak that they also have an internal mental idiolect that's quite different. So, yeah, you know, you have to listen attentively to how people really speak and try and get it down verbatim in order to get that feeling. I mean, on the point of being a page turner and there are no paragraphs or chapters, I mean, a lot of people, I suppose, think of modernism as being anti-natural and kind of odd and artificial. But for us practitioners, it's a highly naturalistic form. The attempt is to capture the flux and the reality of human consciousness. Life isn't in chapters. My life hasn't ordered itself into chapters. Nor is life determined, like the narratives of so many novels, by coincidence. I don't know anybody who's ever told me that their life had a strong plot that turned on a coincidence. So in a way we tend to think of our lives, if we think of them in those terms, because we derive the paradigms from those of narrative fiction and plug them back into the life. And books like this are an attempt to reverse this and to be true to Stendhal's dictum that art should be the mirror of life rather than vice versa.
I wonder whether Joyce fails in that at some level, because I always feel with Joyce, no, I don't always feel, I sometimes feel with Joyce that he's forgotten about me as the reader, and actually he's caught up in a world of entirely literary artifice that has left both me as a reader and the real world behind. He is in a sort of another cosmos.
I'm a late Joycean. I think that, you know, people who've compared this work to Ulysses or to Finnegan's Wake, I think, are wide of the mark. My books are like, Janet and John compared to Ulysses. They're so much easier to read than Ulysses. But nonetheless, you know, I've loved various people in my life, some men, some women, some dogs. But I think I would number Leopold Bloom among the men I love. I think that Joyce's creation of that character and is so complete and so believable, and he is such a lovable and a great man. You know, the idea of the ordinary man as a hero is so perfectly encapsulated in his being that it carries me through all of those self-indulgences and obscurities. I'm just so fond of him. I love him. I cry sometimes when I'm reading.
You've also got what's delightful about Joyce, this ability to take anything and use it. So that, of course, there'll be literary stuff, but you'll also have the music of Queen or words you make up, sort of Lewis Caroline words like Schlockenspiel.
Schlockenspiel. Doesn't everybody use that word? It's so applicable. Yes, well, I mean, again, I don't think we think in standard English. I don't actually think we think in language a lot of the time. We think in a kind of stream of perception and imagery that kind of occasionally bubbles up into internal soliloquy. And that's what, you know, in the text, you'll have noted that I have some sections that are italicized, and that's what I think of as vocalized thought. That's the point at which you actually think in words. Because most of the time we don't think in words. And we certainly don't think metaphorically, or not in the way, you know, I don't read a great deal of literary fiction, but I assume some of the people here do, and you certainly do. And do you not find with literary fiction in particular that a lot of it has this kind of form? It goes, dumpty-dumpty-dumpty-dum, like. Dumpty-dumpty-dumpty-dum, as if. Dumpty-dumpty-dumpty-dum, seemingly. And after each of the as ifs or the likes, there'll be a beautifully coined metaphor, you know. Her leg was like the neck of a gazelle. Really? You know, and the tenor of the metaphor will be, you know, and actually, we don't think like that. You never walk into a room and see a woman's leg and think that's like a giraffe's neck. What you might do, particularly if you've taken a bit of LSD, is walk into a room and think, giraffe's neck, no, woman's leg. But that's not the same as a constructed metaphor. So there are no constructed metaphors in these books at all. No. No as-ifs, no likes, no seemingly.
Will Self talking to me at the Melbourne Writers' Festival 10 years ago when I was presenting the show Books and Arts, which covered all the arts. I don't know how we did it, really. I do have another favourite literary interview from that period. It was with another English novelist, actually, Esther Freud, who was at Adelaide Writers' Week. And we started by talking about her early acting career. Here she is on BBC television.
I was stranded on Earth. They sent out a distress call. The Cryons picked it up.
And we told him the Cybermen had invaded our planet.
And I tricked the Cybermen into bringing us here to tell us.
For we need Lytton's help to defeat them. We also need you.
Me?
That's why you were brought here.
Tell us about that.
That's so funny. I can't believe I actually remember saying those lines. And I laughed so much I had to stay back for extra rehearsals. Because I had been brought up with no TV in a kind of rather Amish-style community in the country. And I wanted to become an actress. I had no idea what that meant. I'd never even seen, I don't know what I was thinking being an actress was. I just wanted to leave school and get on with life. That's really what I was saying. I think now I understand that what I wanted to do was tell stories. But I never thought I'd have the discipline, intellectual capacity to write a book. So I thought, great, I want to get out of education as fast as possible. And so at 16, I went to London, started training to be an actress. And age 20, my first professional job was in Doctor Who, where I'm playing a Cryon, someone trying to help the Doctor and his chums, flee some baddies. And I was just sort of speaking in this way with
you
this
were.
Kind of, and you know, we did help them. You can rest assured they arrived at safety.
If you're a Whovian, and many people are Whovians, Esther is playing Threst. The episode is called Attack of the Cybermen. It's 1985. It's the Sixth Doctor, played by Colin Baker. It's a really bad episode.
It's so dull. I never watched it at the time because I just couldn't be bothered. But not so long ago, they released it on DVD and asked me if I would come to a Doctor Who convention and, sign some autographs. I don't know. I just couldn't resist. I was just so curious. And I tried to watch it, but it was just so bad.
It's unwatchable. I'm sorry, unwatchable.
Yeah. I still get royalty checks. They're usually $3.99, but 30 years later, I would say a month never passes that I don't get a royalty check.
Another $3.99 goes into your bank account. Does it come as a check or is it an automatic deposit?
It used to come as a check and it was like, is it worth going to the bank? But now, luckily, it just goes in.
It's just mounting quietly away. How lovely. So you became an actress. Let's talk about this period as an actress, because you've written about this in your novel Lucky Break, which came out in 2010. I had a good summer. I read a lot of your stuff over the summer.
Ah.
So you go to London at the age of 16 to train as an actress at the Drama Centre. And the novel is terribly entertaining, a very evocative novel. And the general impression is that you've gone off to acting school, all these young, hopeful actors, and you've got these acting teachers who really are, well, language warning, I'm about to use a strong term, so you might like to turn off and go and make a cup of tea. They really are pricks.
Yeah.
I mean, they are major, major pains in the bum.
When I saw Whiplash, I don't know if people have seen that, I thought that is what the director of the school was like.
So their aim is to break you down as people because what you are now is inadequate and reassemble you as something called an actor.
Well, that was what they said, but they didn't ever do the reassembling.
Right.
They just broke. And most people just left whimpering, desperate. I mean, I didn't leave desperate because I had my strong family around me, but the other students were often from other parts of Britain who were just renting a bedsit somewhere. It was really devastating, actually. I mean, I still feel quite angry.
Yeah.
I don't think kids are allowed to be treated like that anymore.
Well, I'm sure this was common in acting schools because I knew many drama students here in Australia who at some schools, not all, but at some schools were subjected to the same kind of sort of sadosexual power trip, really, by the people who were in charge of it.
Yeah, very much. I actually edited it, the worst things out of the book, because my agent was concerned I'd be sued. So there were way worse things that I put in. But it was, and also I wanted the book to be entertaining, but there's an undercurrent of cruelty.
Yeah.
In that section. And that's just, I follow the lives of actors from through drama school and right into the first 10 years of their career. And certainly what they used to warn us about was this is a very tough world, but it was never as tough as drama school. So in a way, they did save some kind of pain. It was always nicer than drama school, even when you didn't get the job.
Yeah, so they were toughening you up. Actually, we're making the book sound pretty grim, but it's actually very funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it is all very funny when you look at, you know, how keen young people are to kind of be disciples of these things. As
so
well.
The young actress... You, pretty much, Nell, gets her equity card by playing a penguin in educational theatre. Was there a counterpart in your own career? Was there a penguin role in your own development?
I make a lot of things up, but that is one that I didn't have to, yes.
You were a penguin.
Yeah. I had my first good review in the stage. Esther Freud excelled as Percy the Penguin.
Did Percy the Penguin have a voice? Oh, that's good. Do penguins actually make that noise?
I don't think so, but it worked for the kids.
I don't think penguins sound anything like that.
Yeah.
And then Nell and her roommate, this is in the novel, head off to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, a festival not unlike the Adelaide Fringe Festival, and they have a review called Two Lobsters and a Prawn, which features the two women as crustaceans on roller skates. Now, the sad thing is I think I'd buy tickets to that.
Well, I wish we'd done that show. We actually did a show called I Didn't Know Celery Could Kill You, which was actually a big hit. But, I just thought that was more fun for the book, the crustaceans on roller skates. I think a friend of mine did something like that herself and did a one-woman show about it. So I kind of... I had a lot of things to borrow from my other friends.
Esther Freud there. Gosh, I love listening to that interview all over again. You can easily find the whole thing by searching online. This is Michael Cathcart bringing you the second last stage show ever, reflecting on the fun and the moments of intensity that you and I have shared, stretching back to the start of this century on various art shows here on Radio National. Well, one of my most revealing encounters, I guess, was with the Indian-British writer Salman Rushdie on stage at the Melbourne Writers Festival in 2014. And Rushdie was in a very upbeat, even ebullient mood. He was totally charming. And we began by talking about his early, very happy childhood in what was then the very tolerant and multicultural city known as Bombay. And then came this. So let's jump forward a little to when you're 13, because you leave home.
Yeah.
And you go to the very exclusive rugby school in Warwickshire, which I visited when I was a child. It's a very posh place indeed. It's got these lovely rugby ovals that seem to go, well, not ovals, pitches that seem to go forever. And then The buildings are like castles, aren't they, with sort of battlements?
Well, some of them are
around the top.
I mean, as always with boys' boarding schools, the posh is all on the outside.
Right.
I mean, the inside bit is really rather more like jail than anything else. But yeah, I mean, it's also different now because in those days it was a boys only school. I mean, there was like almost 1,000 boys and no girls, and now it's like most of those schools, it's now pretty fully co-educational. I mean, actually, the boarding house that I stayed in is now a girls' boarding house. So that's been a big change, and I think has been a very civilizing change, you know, because I think anybody who looks at, you know, kids in school knows that that girls have a civilizing effect on boys, you know. I'm not sure how good it is for the girls, but the boys behave better when there are girls around. And I mean, when I was there, they still used to beat children, you know, and they still had fagging. All these things that seemed to belong to the 19th century were still going on at rugby school in the early 60s.
Were you beaten?
I got very close to it, but I was a very good kid. I've made up for it later. There was actually a very nice moment just after the attack on the Satanic Verses began, when some British television reporter went and unearthed my old history teacher at school, now kind of elderly and living in retirement, but they found him somewhere. And he said, who'd have thought such a nice, quiet boy could get into so much trouble?
you have said that it's at rugby that you discovered that you were Indian.
Yeah. Well, not Indian. No, I mean, just that I was foreign.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, you grow up, you don't think of yourself as foreign. You know, you think of yourself as yourself. And it's only when I got to England that I discovered that there was this sense that I was a kind of other, you know, that I wasn't one of them. I was other.
Yeah.
And I think I said it somewhere in the book that it struck me that at the boys' boarding school there were 3 unforgivable sins, and you could get away with 2 of them, but not all 3. And the 3 unforgivable sins are being clever, foreign, and bad at games. If you're clever and foreign, but you're a brilliant cricketer, all is forgiven.
Right.
If you're clever and bad at games, but you're not foreign, then you get away with it, and so on. You know, you could get it, but I had the triple whammy, you know.
And did that shake your self-confidence? Because one of the things that's stunning about you is that through thick and thin, you have been a man of astonishing self-confidence.
I don't know. Is that so? That might be like rugby school. It's on the outside. No, I was very unhappy at school.
So you're a lost little boy, are you?
Yeah, and I lied to my parents because I thought they've sent me all this way and, you know, it's costing them all this money and I shouldn't... So I would write them these letters that were my first real fictions, you know. had a great week, scored 23 not out, etc.
Now, Rushdie was famous, very famous, because his 1988 novel, The Satanic Verses, had so inflamed the outrage of some Muslims that the leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, had declared a fatwa calling on the faithful to kill Rushdie. And Rushdie responded to this by going into a long period of hiding, taking sanctuary with various friends in secluded locations around England, all the while shadowed by the British Secret Service. And when I spoke to him in this interview, he decided to resume his public life, and he told the story of his ordeal in a memoir called Joseph Anton. Now, this is the issue. Many people, many friends, terrified for his safety, had urged him to withdraw the Satanic Verses. Why would you risk your life for a novel? Just take it off sale. Why didn't he do that?
That would have been cowardly, craven, disgusting and shameful. That's why. and you know, the history of literature is one in which writers have defended their work, you know, and I wasn't going to be the one who didn't. But you're right, the question that I had to ask myself, if somebody's trying to kill you because of something you've said or written or whatever, you have to ask yourself if it's worth dying for.
Yes, it's a novel. So, is a novel worth all this?
Well, two things are worth all this. One is a principle of freedom of speech, which goes a long way beyond my own book. You either have it or you don't. You know, you lose the freedoms you don't defend. And I thought that was probably worth fighting for. And the other was the question of terrorism. And it seemed to me that if you give in to terrorism, you guarantee that there will be more of it. You know, you don't make peace with it. It doesn't go away. You by surrendering to it, you make sure that it will happen again and again and again. And so it seemed to me that there were two things that were having to be defended. One was the right of people in free societies to say what they chose without being physically endangered because of the attitudes of medievalist tyrants in other countries. You know, that was one thing. And the other thing was just this very high principle of the freedom of speech without which all other freedoms disappear. And to have to, and if you're like me, and you're a kind of writer who's essentially satirical by nature, it's much easier to know the things that you are against than the things that you stand for, you know. And in this case, what I was against was pretty damn easy. You know, somebody's tried to kill me, I was against it. You know, should you be killed because you wrote a book somebody didn't like? My answer to that, my view is that that's a yes-no question, you know. And for the record, my answer is no, you know. So that part was easy. What was more difficult and necessary and serious was to try and work out what I thought we were defending, you know. And I did. I mean, I think I did, and I think that's what I've just said is what I believe. Mm. I mean, I also think, by the way, that it's a damn good novel. Anyway, I felt that just quietly, privately, I was also hoping for the quality defense to rear its head. And what I'd like now, that we're so many years down the line, I mean, this is a very long time ago, you know, it's a quarter of a century ago, is that people are finally able to read that novel as a novel, you know, and not just as a kind of some kind of political hot potato.
So there you have it. For Rushdie, it's all about freedom of speech. And Salman Rushdie will be back in Australia in August this coming year, the year 2026.
I first saw this man in a show called Drink Pepsi, Bitch. That was around 2006. A year later, he was back playing Alexander Downer in Keating the Musical. Then he was playing Australia's larrikin spin bowler Shane Warne in a musical show he wrote himself. He won a Helpman for that one. Since then, he's opened two new shows on Broadway and been nominated for a Tony. Yes, on the stage show today, we welcome singer, actor, composer, writer, piano player, Eddie Perfect.
Thank you.
Isn't this nice to be face-to-face?
In a room?
In a room with each other.
With a piano and each other. It's delightful.
I've been broadcasting from a corner of my house for 12 months almost.
Well, haven't we all?
And this is the first. Yes, you're no one special, Michael. Hey, welcome back. So, you're about to open a new, it says, very reflective show, introspective at the Malthouse in Melbourne because you've been in New York.
Yes. I spent the last 2 years living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan on 76th Street, right next to Central Park, with my wife and two kids for the last 2 years working on two musicals simultaneously. It was exciting, but I would never do anything like that ever again.
But you have been a megastar. I mean, we've been reading about you in the paper and thinking, oh, my Lord, he's really made it.
Well, that's nice. I mean, it was a fantastic experience. It was an amazing experience. It was a very intense experience. And then we'd already made the decision to come back to Melbourne to put our kids through high school, and also because it felt like time, and mostly because, you know, I never felt like New York was going to be my home. As much as I enjoy it, I feel at my heart incredibly Australian.
That's how my 2021 interview started with Eddie Perfect in the ABC Music Studio here in Melbourne. Eddie was just home from living and working in New York, he'd had two shows running on Broadway within months of each other. And the first one, King Kong, was a massively expensive and much-hyped show which had completely bombed. And then came Eddie's musical Beetlejuice, and the first review in the Washington Post was terrible too, and it was so public, he said he felt as though he was having the absolute crap kicked out of him. Those were his words. And that's when he wrote one of his most beautiful songs ever, I reckon, inspired by the pluckiness of the starlings of New York from the moment they first hatch as fledgling chicks.
A New York starling starts its life in an apartment. Well, not in an apartment, but a nest out on the ledge. And while it waits on feathers, it puts up with the weather before it gets its shit together. It plummets off the edge. Hate to question nature here, but that just seems absurd. On the sidewalk, crowds march by, but who's got time for birds? Central Park's across the street with trees and green. Would that not be preferred? Maybe they're territorial. Maybe that's all they've known.
It's a lovely song, isn't it? Well, then a showbiz miracle happened. Audiences and some critics loved the new show, Beetlejuice. It was nominated for multiple Tony Awards. It didn't win any, but it made Eddie's reputation. He was back. He was in favour as the writer and composer of a massive hit. And since then, that show has gone on to international success. And Eddie continues to be one of our much-loved theatre personalities. Now, 5 years ago, the Perth First Nations company Yiriyarkin performed Macbeth in Noongar language, and they renamed it Hecate, and this show was amazing, unforgettable, all in language, no subtitles, and if you knew the play, you could follow everything that was happening. It was a breathtaking production of the play, and I brought you a live broadcast from Perth Festival where the play was staged.
Well, let's talk about this project. Kylie Bracknell joins us. She's the co-translator and the director of this show.
Language is not just about the spoken word. Human language is about watching, feeling, listening, connecting. And so even though Shakespeare was this great playwright and writer, he was also a man. He was also a human being who paid attention to the elements and the relationships and the people, the creatures, if you will, that he was writing about. He did his research in a way where he understood the language. The pentameter of his writing is to a heartbeat. There are so many connections with him. And in doing my research and adapting this work and watching Sir Ian McKellen speak about the actor's point of view and perspective. In order to play a character, you must understand the dialogue of that character. But in order to understand the dialogue of the character, you should really pay attention to the dialogue of the inner thinking of the writer to create that dialogue for that character. So to understand the writer is to understand the person who wrote it. He's not just a writer, he's a human being with immense intellect and feeling and heart. Many people would surely know that by reading his work. They revere his work more so than him. So I wanted to take away the surtitles and the subtitles, or whatever titles you want to put on things, to remind us of language and what it actually is, because many people have forgotten. I mean, we had a gentleman in the audience in the front row last night, not to shame you out, Mr. Whoever you are, but who was sitting there reading the synopsis for 85 to 90% of the show. And I felt really sad for him. I felt sad for him because he was missing out on the energy and the movement. The drawing in is missed. And that's a language. We've forgotten that language. I mean, we need signs for everyone these days. That's how much written language is revered. You need a sign to say, clean up after yourself.
Get off your phone. You might
want to get your car. What happened to actually paying attention to people's body language and how they might be feeling, or if they don't want to shake your hand, or if they smile at you, is that enough? I mean, we don't need surtitles. We need to actually connect with human beings again in a way where it's going to benefit our mental health and our heart.
Well, we're going to have another piece of performance now, which I really think demonstrates that point beautifully. What are we about to hear?
We are about to hear a section of Shakespeare's Macbeth that is usually never sung, I'm sure. This is a tribute to the fact that Noongar people and Aboriginal culture sing a lot. The vibration is healing. The songs are always uplifting, even if they are about sad things. So in adapting this work and in speaking to my co-translator, Dr. Clint Bracknell, we wanted to honour song in this work. And so this is the sergeant coming from the battlefield to convey to King Duncan what he'd seen out there and to speak about how amazing Macbeth was in honouring his name. This is performed by Ian Mupa Wilkes.
Karichport Yaking Mamingura. Balap Ngari Mocking. Balabarang dorokanan bawort bining Nyonit nyon Balawambal tinangan ang kitya buborn in a kwel kinabal Kitya bilang bilang ang kwel kinabal Nyonit ngan Minitialang upam in a kwel kinabal Kwak kwari dinabal, kitya kwari dinabal Waramana waramana noit kwan
Fwa Macbeth. Balang quel quabich quap.
Bal kakawin. Kweji kijaket. Bal wokich. Kij naring don. Balang bil babalang mat ngopol yang. Babalang kart. Yiran gijibam. Nortwoling. Ngayon na nga bin. Ngan men di jiwalangin.
Actor Ian Wilkes in Yuri Arkin's Hecate, and you met director Kylie Bracknell and performer Kyle J. Morrison. And that was produced by my longtime stage show producer, Kim Jurek. Thanks, Kim, for 8 years of working together, including bringing our audiences the stage show during COVID, when you and I were both working from our homes. And I don't know how we made a stage show because all the theatres were closed. That's the Australian recorder virtuoso Genevieve Lacey playing a discount recorder made out of Australian mulga, a beautiful instrument. And getting to know Genevieve and her wonderful playing has been one of the joys of my time here. In 2017, I asked her when she first knew that she had what it took to make a career as a recorder player.
I think I was actually in my mid-20s by the time I was prepared to admit to myself that maybe I did have it in me. I'd been striving for that for a long time. I started playing when I was really little, and I always loved the sound of this instrument and the feel of it. And I played other instruments as well because, you know, any child with an aptitude for the recorder is quickly moved onto a proper instrument, as I was. But yeah, I've always loved this. And finally, after years of study and extraordinary teachers and opportunities, I thought, you know what? I think maybe there's something in us in this.
When I hear you play, I'm always struck by the way in which you can make the instrument sound contemporary. When I first heard the recorder taken to a new level, it was by people like Franz Bruggen playing early music, and you play early music as well. But you make early music, even early music sounds that it belongs in the now. And I don't know how you do that, but there is a kind of, perhaps it's your Australianness, there's a kind of clarity and sunshine to the way you play.
Thanks, Michael. That's lovely. And me making early music sounding contemporary has definitely got me into trouble in some times and places. But I think your Australianness, I think you're really onto something there. There is something about the wide open spaces that we grow up in and the fact that we're not so beholden to traditions in a way that perhaps my European colleagues might be. That gives us an incredible freedom of imagination. But also for me, I've always been really interested in trying to make music speak now. So whether it comes from the 15th century or it was written just a few weeks ago, for me the point is hearing it live in a room and the exchange between the people listening and the people playing. So I'm delighted if it does always sound alive and contemporary, because that's certainly how it is within me, and that's what I'm hoping to communicate.
Now, between 2009 and 2012, I just had the enormous pleasure of co-hosting Bush Telegraph here on ABC Radio National. This was a show that brought stories from regional Australia and the bush to the rest of the country, to those of us in big cities, I guess. It also had an enormous following in the regions. And this is part of my favourite ever interview for Bush Telegraph. Now, we'd spent a week driving from Darwin to Alice, bringing you live shows from the road each day. And at a stopover at Daly Waters, there was a lot of talk about a young woman called Keita Docking, a young Jillaroo who'd suffered a brain injury in a shocking accident when she'd been thrown by her own horse. And the talk was all about Keita's efforts with the support of friends and her mother Gladys to ride 500 k's from Timber Creek to Daly Waters. And their goal was to raise money for an outfit called Integrated Disability Action, a facility which was assisting people living with disabilities. Well, next morning we took to the road, and who should we come across but this remarkable woman?
So we've stopped our car at the side of the Stuart Highway, just turned off down a dirt track here, because we've seen a group of horses and we think we know what's going on here. Hello, it's Gladys, isn't it?
Yeah, Gladys, yeah.
Tell us what you're doing here.
We're on the last stage of our horse ride from Timber Creek to Daly Waters for my daughter Keita. She had a horse accident 7.5 years ago, and one of her dreams was to do a big ride somewhere, and so we decided to start at Timber Creek and go through to Daly Waters, and in the process raise some funds to set up an activity centre for other survivors of acquired brain injury.
So, Keita, it's lovely to be talking to you. How are you going?
Good, thank you.
And how are you finding the ride?
Excellent.
It's a beautiful day to be out in the country.
Yes, it is. Very nice day.
Do you remember the accident?
I can remember getting knocked out and being hung up in the stirrup.
Kid was chasing a steer in a camp drafting thing, and the steer and the horse got tangled. Hocking, they call it, and the steer, the horse and Keita all went down together, and it was just a big cloud of dust. But doctors are pretty certain that the horse actually rolled over and squashed her head, which is what caused all the really serious brain damage.
Oh, gee. Well, she's a lucky girl to be here, and you're a lucky mum.
I'm very lucky. She's very lucky to be here. Sometimes she doesn't think so, you know. I mean, depression's a pretty big thing in this type of thing, especially when you've got enough intelligence to remember what you were and what you're not now. But, yes, she's lucky, and I'm lucky that she's here.
Right. Do you remember what you were like before the accident?
Yes, I do. I think I was pretty well, doing everything and helpful for everyone.
And what made you take this on, Gladys?
To prove to Keita that she's better than she thinks she is, that she's come up, because she was a very active, strong Jillaroo before the accident. And she tends to have problems with coming to grips with what she is now, because she knows what she was and what she can't do now. So part of it was for her to prove that she had a lot to give and could do a lot and had improved, you know, a million times better than she should have done. But also, hopefully, to encourage others to just not accept that they've had a brain injury and they're no good, because it tends to be the sort of theme from medical people, and that, well, you've got a brain injury, just stay there and except that's what you've got. We're trying to show that that doesn't have to be. With a little bit of determination and a bit of stimulation, you can do things like ride 500 kilometres on a horse.
Keita, this is your horse over here just behind us. Tell us about the horse.
Brumby. Well, she's very quiet and, I know what you'd call her, playful with you. Like, she eats a bag of chips when you have them. She'll snatch them off, yeah? Yeah. Yeah.
And have you had her long?
A few years, yeah.
And what's her name?
Brumby.
Oh, she's called Brumby. Oh, I see. And she's the horse that you had the accident on?
Yeah, she is. And she's still quiet. But I had to get a lady named Jeanette Wilson come up and re-educate me and my horse. Just brought me and Brumby back together as a loving couple.
That's lovely. Keita Docking from the Northern Territory. And that, my friends, is Curtains. The stage show was produced this week by Rosa Ellen with help from Anita Barrow. We'll be back for the last ever stage show at the same time next week. To take us out, here's a performance we brought you earlier this year from mezzo-soprano Anna Dowsley in Opera Australia's production of Dido and Aeneas.
Oh, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.